Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Yad Vashem, fine-tuning the panel pertaining to Pius XII. Archbishop Coleridge of Brisbane in Australia defines his areas of mission. Nemi and Caligula's naval battles. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Museum and Memorial, on Sunday 1st of July fine-tuned the wording of an exhibit pertaining to Pius XII's actions during World War II as a result of more recent research following the opening of archives regarding the pontificate of Pius XI, the Roman pontiff who came before him. Pius XII was Pope from 1939 to 1958. Changes begin with the title of the panel, which is now the Vatican, rather than Pope Pius XII. Also among the changes is the wording that when Jews were deported from Rome, this Pope, quote, did not publicly protest, unquote, rather than, quote, he did not intervene, unquote. Mentioned, too, is the passage in Pius XII's 1942 Christmas radio message in which he speaks of the hundreds of thousands of persons who, without any fault of their own, sometimes only because of their nationality or ethnic origin, have been consigned to death or to a slow decline because of their ethnicity. Following this quotation is the comment, Jews were not explicitly mentioned. Worthy of note is the fact that the new museum panel addresses the alleged silence of Pius XII by critics who say this wartime pope could have done more to stop the deportation of Jews. The exact words on the panel are the pope's critics claim that his decision to abstain from condemning the murder of the Jews by Nazi Germany constitutes a moral failure. The lack of clear guidance left room for many to collaborate with Nazi Germany, reassured by the thought that this did not contradict the Church's moral teachings. The panel, however, also points to those who have spoken out in defence of Pius XII. Quote, his defenders maintain that this neutrality prevented harsher measures against the Vatican and the Church's institutions throughout Europe, thus enabling a considerable number of secret rescue activities to take place at different levels of the Church. At this point, why don't you stay tuned and make up your own minds as I step back in time in an effort to bring you documented, dated evidence of the time regarding this wartime pope.
Habemus Papam! Sancte Romane Ecclesie Cardinalem Pacelli.
March 2, 1939, Pope Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli, was elected as successor of Peter. Germany was quick to react. The very next day, the Berliner Morgenpost, a Nazi propaganda paper, wrote,
The election of Cardinal Pacelli is not accepted with favour in Germany because he was always opposed to Nazism.
Six months later, the world was at war, and the new Pope was making a last desperate appeal for peace through the microphones of Vatican Radio.
Imminente è il pericolo, ma è ancora tempo. Nulla è perduto con la pace. Tutto può esserlo con la guerra.
Nothing is lost with peace. Everything could be lost with war.
Trattando con buona volontà e con rispetto dei reciproci diritti, si accorgeranno dai sinceri.
Less than a month after the outbreak of the Second World War, Pius XII published his first encyclical, Summi Pontificatus, on the unity of human society, In the encyclical, the new pope branded racial prejudice as the most pernicious of modern errors and condemned, quote, the forgetfulness of that law of human solidarity dictated by the equality of rational nature in all persons to whatever people they belong, unquote. On October the 28th, 1939, in Britain, the Times commented on the encyclical under the headline, New Idolatry Condemned. And across the Atlantic, the New York Times carried an almost identical headline.
Pope condemns persecution.
The New York Times editorial ran as follows.
The voice of Pius XII is a lonely voice in the silence and darkness enveloping Europe this Christmas. He is about the only ruler left on the continent of Europe who dares to raise his voice at all.
Della vera grandezza, imponendo silenzio alle voci della passione.
With this kind of documented, dated evidence, how is it that the memory of Pius XII is still marred by criticism and accusations that not only did he fail to condemn the Nazi ideology, but that he was silent over the murder of 6.5 million Jews? Listen now to the Pope's first Christmas message addressed to the world at war on Christmas Eve 1939.
Questa guerra mondiale e tutto ciò che le si connette.
The world seems to have forgotten Christ's message of peace, the voice of reason, of Christian brotherhood. We have had to witness acts that are irreconcilable with international law, with the principles of human rights, and with the most basic human sentiments. I refer to the premeditated aggression of a minority of hard-working and peaceful people, to the atrocities committed against non-combatants, refugees, the aged, women and children, acts which cry out to God for vengeance.
Queste serie di azioni contrastanti con lo spirito umano e cristiano. Le convenzioni internazionali per rendere meno.
Esta ex in un delantein! Esta ex in soldaten begrüßen!
And then, as the horror of the war became more explicit, Pope Pius XII too became more explicit in his condemnation of the atrocities. Again, it was Christmas, and the war had been raging for 3 years.
Questo voto l'umanità lo deve agli innumerevoli morti che giacciono sepolti nei campi di guerra. Il sacrificio della loro vita nel compimento del loro dovere è l'olocausto.
Hundreds of thousands of persons, through no fault of their own, sometimes only for reasons of nationality or race, are destined to death or to a gradual extinction.
And once again, Germany was quick to react. The Gestapo, Hitler's feared police force, issued a report on that message, which was delivered to the Führer himself. This is what it read.
In a manner never known before, the Pope has repudiated the National Socialist New European Order. It is true, the Pope does not refer to the National Socialists in Germany by name, but his speech is one long attack on everything we stand for. Here, he is clearly speaking on behalf of the Jews.
Ask you, what kind of race could he have had in mind except the Jews? You see, everybody understood this perfectly well, and especially the Nazi authorities understood that, as did the fascist authorities, and there were many protests about this.
Jesuit Father Peter Gumpel,
former relator
for the cause of canonization of Pius XII, knew him personally.
Of these messages, understood it perfectly well. I said those who were able, because the Vatican radio at the time had a very weak transmission. It was not easy to capture it. Of course, in Germany, foreign newspapers could not be published. Listening to foreign radios during the war was punishable by death. So many of the statements of the Pope couldn't reach the German public. But I lived in Germany under Hitler, at least till 1939, and every Catholic knew exactly what the Catholic Church, the bishops, and the Pope were thinking about the persecution of Jews. I think Pius XII did everything he could possibly do to save Jews, and many Jews have admitted that, Jewish historians and others.
Albert Einstein was one prominent member of the Jewish community who was quick to recognize Pius XII's courage in speaking out against the Nazi ideology. He said as much in an article published in Time magazine in 1940.
Being a lover of freedom, when the revolution came in Germany, I looked to the universities to defend it, knowing that they had always boasted of their devotion to the cause of truth. But no, the universities immediately were silenced. Then I looked to the great editors of the newspapers, whose flaming editorials in days gone by had proclaimed their love of freedom. But they, like the universities, were silenced in a few short weeks. Only the church stood squarely across the path of Hitler's campaign for suppressing truth.
In 1943, Hitler's propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, wrote in his diary,
"Again and again, reports reached us that the Pope is feverishly at work during this entire crisis."
Documented testimonies like these are overlooked or blatantly ignored by those who insist on their own one-sided view of history.
And it is a sorry fact that now, 20 years or so later, the attack was launched against Pius XII, that he, for financial reasons or out of cowardice or because he was pro-Hitler, did never do anything for the Jews. This is a real falsification of history. Nowadays, many people who write about it, I'm not speaking now only about 20 years, we are now about 50 years removed from the Second World War, many of these people were not even born. Many of these people have never lived under a political dictatorship and a police state, as we had to live in Germany at that time. And therefore, they are practically, psychologically, not in a position to assess what really went on in Germany and what the possibilities were to do something for people. I think that's the reason. There may be other reasons underneath, because, to tell you very frankly, I have talked with a number of Jewish scholars and journalists, and it has been amazing to me that if I asked them whether they ever read or saw or knew about the 11 volumes published by the Vatican on what has happened during the Second World War, a number of them said they had never even heard of it, let alone studied it.
Our first job was to get out the Fisher Publication, namely what is in the archives. But there are many things which are not in the archives and can't be, you know, simply the human drama behind all these papers. So what I would do in the summers and the winters, I would make the rounds of the various archives in Bonn and Koblenz and Berlin and Paris and London and Washington, D.C., where the background of these situations are on the record. And so much of this case...
Jesuit historian Father Robert Graham, foremost expert on the Vatican and World War II, spent 14 years researching and writing those 11 volumes. He too knew Pius XII personally.
Downgraded, systematically downgraded. And the four volumes that the Vatican published over the papal relief during the war has been systematically put aside, ignored. Well, now that's not honest. It isn't even moral. But it's certainly a proof that of the partiality of the type of propaganda that we've been reading in the press for a good number of years now. The series is known as the victims of the war. And it was not really in Rome. There was a lot about Rome, but also the things that, what happened in Poland and in Russia and in Germany and in France also, in terms of the predicament of the poor, innocent victims of the war.
Today, the millions of suffering children are looking with appealing eyes to the vicar of Jesus. Let them come to us. Let no one hold them off. We love them all with the love of Christ, and we cannot rest so long as the pangs of hunger make them cry out for help.
Some people have told me that they had the impression, people who lived during the war, felt that if Pope Pius XII had spoken out more loudly,
the Catholics would have been persecuted after the Jews?
I'm perfectly convinced, first of all, that Pope Pius XII would have received absolutely nothing in the way of saving Jews if he had spoken out. That is the first thing to be said. And there are several arguments to substantiate this fact. He seriously considered to do so. And in his Christmas elocution and elsewhere, he spoke about the illegitimacy and the evil to persecute people just on account of their religion and their race. And I said already that everybody understood, at least also the people who knew about it, and the Nazi authority and the fascist authorities complained about these allusions that the Pope made there. He did not mention the term Jews, but that because the term Jew worked as a red cloth on Hitler, and it would have aggravated the situation. And I am personally convinced, having lived under Hitler and having studied these things for many years now, that any public statement of the Pope not only would not have saved a single Jewish life, but would have aggravated the situation of the Jews, and at the same time would have caused an even severer persecution of the Roman Catholic Church, and thus have prevented so many Catholics to help Jews in all secrecy. And this has been done, and unfortunately, in contemporary literature, is belittled or simply ignored or glossed over as if this had not happened.
Well, I hope you found this program interesting. What I'd like to do now is pick up on last week's interview, on a totally different note, with the Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia, Mark Benedict Coleridge, who last week explained the meaning of the pallium. And in a moment, we'll identify, at my request, three areas of mission he feels he would like to implement in his home archdiocese. If you like to identify three areas of mission.
Three areas of mission. Well, one is certainly passing on the treasures of the faith to the young. That can't be taken for granted, nor is it done by process of cultural osmosis as it was once upon a time. Once upon a time, you were born into a Catholic family, went to a Catholic school, you became a GLC, good little Catholic. Now, that is not true anymore. There are ruptures that have intervened. So to pass on the treasures of the faith to the young, and to find the right words, images and gestures to do that. That's absolutely critical.
To ensure the future, in other words.
To ensure the future, not just in terms of recruits, but the young have a right to receive the glorious gift of the gospel. So we have to engage the young in all kinds of ways. But more generally, I would say that we have to engage the culture in new ways. It is utterly foreign to the Catholic Church simply to turn our back on the culture and talk to ourselves. And very often we do seem marginal in cultures like the one that I know best in Australia. So we have to find new ways of engaging the culture with words and images and gestures that communicate, because very often the way we're saying things or doing things isn't communicating. I know this as a teacher. When you're teaching, you can look down and see the glazed look on your student's face, and you think, well, I've got to find another word or image to communicate. And if you do find the right word or image, you can see that the penny drops and the scales drop from their eyes, and you think, finally I have communicated. Well, that's where we are as a church. We've got to find that kind of thing. The third thing I would say is that we have to become a more contemplative church, that none of this will happen unless we have a new and deeper encounter with Jesus Christ crucified and risen. By that I mean Jesus Christ is never just a role model or a wise teacher whose teachings we must strive to follow, or a role model from the distant past whom we must strive to emulate. That is simply not what Christianity is. We need to encounter him as presence and power in the here and now, and that new, as I would call it, contemplative encounter, seeing the face of Jesus, hearing his voice, is where any genuine newness will start. So they're the three things that I would identify. I could go on.
What about the liturgy?
The liturgy is absolutely fundamental, because it's the prime locus of that encounter with Jesus Christ, who speaks to us in a unique way in that liturgical moment, and who gives himself as the Word made flesh in the sacrament of the bread and wine. So I think the whole process of liturgical renewal, is the ongoing journey of liturgical renewal, is crossing a new threshold at this moment. And the crucial thing to remember at a threshold moment like this is that the liturgical renewal that has its impetus from the Second Vatican Council, though its roots lie in the Council of Trent, was all about generating new energy for mission. It wasn't about some kind of rather fussy ecclesiastical liturgical interior decorating. It was all about enabling a more powerful, more energizing encounter with the risen Christ in word and sacrament that would generate the new energy for mission. So I do think the liturgy is fundamental. Over the years I've been bishop, my energy is almost totally absorbed at times by the retranslation of the Roman Missal, and that has convinced me that the liturgy is fundamental to this new surge of gospel energy that I think the Church requires and to which we've been called by the Holy Spirit. It's by no means accidental that at the Second Vatican Council, the great grace given to the Church in the 20th century, as John Paul II said, that the Council began with the liturgy. And the very first of the great documents of the Council was Sacrosanctum Concilium, on the liturgy. So I do think the liturgy is fundamental in order to generate that energy for mission.
Anniversary of the first session. Second Vatican Council is coming up in October, and the Pope has launched a year of faith to coincide with that, and it's connected to new evangelization. What do you think the effort really is? Is it to bring new energy into the Church?
Well, the Pope believes, and I actually think he's very acute in his analysis, that there is a genuine crisis of faith in the Church at this time, even among the devout. Problems are not sort of, as it were, merely strategic or in some superficial sense ideological. The fundamental challenge is at the point of faith. And where, therefore, and this sounds almost crude to say it, but where does God stand in the midst of things? Because many people, one is tempted to say most people, live their lives as if God didn't exist or doesn't exist. So I think the Pope is right in saying that there is this fundamental crisis of faith. And even among the devout, that sense of the fear of hell and the longing for heaven, the sense of this world being only a pilgrim place where we journey into the fullness of life, even that is severely diminished. And that's part of the crisis of faith that Benedict XVI, I think, has described very accurately. So I think in part what Benedict XVI is doing is saying that that's what the Council was about. And I think, again, he's right in the sense that the Second Vatican Council was, in part at least, the Church's response to the dual apocalypse of World War I and World War II. I mean, the question people asked after World War II with the ash heaps of Auschwitz and Hiroshima was, is there a future? I mean, in part that question is there a God at all? Elie Wiesel, the famous Jewish author who spent years in Auschwitz, said that everyone emerged from the death camps asked how could there possibly be a God after the hellhole that they had seen. And I think the world in many ways is still asking that question and is still in the shadow of the twin apocalypse of World War I and World War II. So that I think what the Pope is doing is pointing to what was at the heart of the Council and remembering that he was one of the Pariti. I think John Paul II, through his long reign as Pope, was saying the same thing. This was the heart of the Council. That phrase, new evangelization, is never found in the Council. But what John Paul II was saying, but that's what the Council was all about. And Benedict XVI, in his different way, is saying, what the Council was all about, and let's remember it in this 50th year, the Council was all about a resurgence of the power of faith. And I might just add that before the Pope proclaimed the Year of Faith in Australia, the Australian bishops had proclaimed in Australia a Year of Grace from Pentecost to Pentecost. So we announced this to the Pope when we were here for the Ad Limina visit in October. And about 2 weeks later, the Pope proclaimed a Year of Faith. So we like to think that he thought our idea was so good, he'd proclaim his own year. And what we've been saying to our people is there's a very elegant segue between the Year of Grace and the Year of Faith. Grace is God's gift to us, and we have to enter into that mystery more and more deeply, take hold of the fact, the gift. But faith is the human response to the gift, the accepting of the gift. So there's no abrasion of any kind between the year of grace and the year of faith. Instead, an elegant segue, a harmony between gift and response.
And you were listening there to the Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia, Mark Benedict Coleridge. Our thanks go to him. Finally, I couldn't resist. Given Pope Benedict XVI is going to leave his residence in Castel Gandolfo in the Alban Hills next Monday to visit a nearby town familiar to him, where he's scheduled to call precisely at the residence of the Divine Word missionaries, a place especially meaningful to him as he himself resided there in 1964, in the years when he was in Rome attending the Second Vatican Council as Spiritus. All that to take you down to Lake Nemi, on a completely different note, where the Roman Emperor Caligula once kept a few ships for fun. But do join me as I banter on about these ships with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Get ready for the change of pace and a little aqua fun. You go up to Nemi. In the lake there, there's still ships from the Roman times.
Yeah, well, what's left of them? What's left, because the Germans burnt them in 1944. But what you had there were two ships of Caligula, and they used to have battles on the lake. But what Caligula did was build two massive ships for parties. He used to have parties on these massive...
Okay, so how do you say ship in Latin?
Well, it's navis.
Ship parties?
Okay.
Aquafan.
Navali or navicola, or I don't know, festivitatis navicolae. But that's where you get Piazza Navona from, too, because that was all flooded, too, and they had boats around there in the Middle Ages. It's all the thing.
Today we have places called Aquafan.
Aqua Park.
And aqua is already...
Water already.
Water fun.
Aquarum delicie. Delicie, the delights of water. You can say this in a million ways. Mm. And so they had these battles. One was along the Tiber River up near the Vatican. The Colosseum used to be used for naval battles for a few years, and then they stopped it. And they dug out the floor, and they took out the water, and they had to use the floor of the basement there for animals and different things. But that's the Naumachia, were the ship battles.
The Romans really liked to play, and there's one word still in usage today that highlights this, is ludicrous.
Yeah, ludus, of course, was to play. Ludo ludere is to play.
But ludicrous has a different meaning.
Well, ludicrous means like laughable or jokeable or... In fact, is ludicra in the Latin dictionary, means sport events. So we say ludicrous is kind of funny, but ludicra for the Romans were sport events in the neuter plural, ludicra.
Were they rowdy, the Romans who watched all these battles?
Oh, yeah. Yes, and sometimes it got out of hand, and then the emperors would have to send in the police and kill them all.
How'd you say out of hand?
You're going to say ex leges or ex tores, ex leges. They were out of the law. And there was one time, I think it was Caligula. He was over on the Palatine Hill, and he heard people in the circus screaming and yelling, and his sleep was disturbed, and he told the police to go in, and they killed them all, like 3,000 people.
Oh, so they were
because they were causing trouble for the Emperor Caligula.
And my thanks there go to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.